Welcome back. Hour number two. That would be two of three on the Mike Malloy Show. Welcome back. This is my final night here of the week in for Mike Malloy, the vacationing Mike Malloy. He will be back Monday, never fear. Until then, you got me, Brad Friedman of bradblog.com, your friendly citizen investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow from bradblog.com. Glad you could join us. We are, in a few minutes, we'll be joined live by Rick Piltz. He was, from 1989 to 2005, a senior associate in the office of the Federal Climate Science Program. And in 2005, he resigned from that role, coming out and basically, he became a whistleblower, telling the world that the Bush administration had been essentially censoring, editing out references to climate change and global warming in their scientific reports. It was an extraordinary story at the time, at least to me in 2005. I believe I caught it on the in the New York Times way back then. And such was the media in the dark, dark days of the Bush administration that there was not the kind of media, frankly, that we see today. They were very compliant in the post-9/11 era. And I was able to get in touch with Rick Piltz and had him actually on the air back in 2005 in what was his first full-length on-air interview at the time. As I mentioned in the first hour, on the very day that I had him on, I also had Cindy Sheehan on before she went down and became famous down there at Crawford, Texas, trying to get a meeting with the George Bush to find out what the noble cause was that her son had died for. She was on my show at the time. I had a weekend show back then. It's about a four-hour show on Saturday. It was almost entirely just on the internets back then, as we were trying to go anywhere, do anything we could to get the word out about what the hell was going on. So I had her on that day, and I also had Rick Piltz. At the time, Rick wasn't available that afternoon, so we taped an interview that we then aired on the show in two different parts. And back then, we were so low rent, like we're not low rent now, but we were even lower rent back then, that when I interviewed him on the telephone, as you'll hear in this, I'm going to play a few minutes from this interview before we have him on. We were both on the phone. I didn't even have the proper recording equipment. So we're both on the telephone for about 5 minutes here. But this is my interview with Rick Piltz just after he had resigned from the Office of the Federal Climate Science Program. This interview originally aired June 18, 2005. We'll play a few minutes of that, and then we'll take a break and come back with Rick Piltz live to see how that whole whistleblower thing has turned out and what Rick is up to now.
The office I worked for was involved in coordinating a dozen federal agencies that support this research, you know, NASA and the National Science Foundation and the Pentagon and EPA and so forth. And so the science professionals would write these things, and they would review them and revise them among themselves in a bit, what I seem to me to be a very straightforward and professional kind of way. And then the document would have to go for a kind of a high-level White House clearance before it could be published.
And at that stage, people
whose basic job was not science, but to advance the administration's political agenda, would step in and start introducing a lot of changes in the documents, and the net effect of all of the kinds of changes that they would make and try to make in documents was to basically play down the global warming problem, divert attention from discussion of impacts of climate change. It was a kind of way of diffusing any sense of urgency about the issues, manufacturing a greater sense of scientific uncertainty than you would get from the scientists themselves.
Do you have an opinion, a speculation about why this administration would be so interested in removing the references and so forth to global warming? I mean, what is it exactly that they're after? Do you have proof of what they're after, or are you just connecting the dots, so to speak, as far as why they want to?
I think it's connecting the dots in that it seems to me evident in this area and in energy policy and in a number of other policy areas that this administration is very responsive to a certain type of corporate constituency, the big energy companies and so forth, and they have political allies on the Hill and in think tanks and advocacy groups that are all kind of on the same page, but they have an agenda that is responsible to their main supporters in the corporate world, it just seems to me clear that the motivation is, if you really have a forthright, honest discussion of what is coming out of the climate science research, the impacts, the implications of climate change, I think that they're afraid, and rightly so, that you would have a more public pressure to consider having a stronger policy on reducing emissions of greenhouse gases, and that is something that they don't want.
Well,
it's a strategy to fend off something that might have some regulatory impact on their corporate allies by exaggerating the sense of scientific uncertainty about the climate change problem.
Why were you not able to talk about these things without resigning? Or did you feel that you had to resign in order to be able to speak your mind on these issues?
Well, I think you'll find that there are a lot of people on the inside and certainly a lot of people in the science community who see what I'm seeing and who it has sort of a chilling effect, and I think on some people a demoralizing effect. But you can't be too much openly a dissident if you are a federal program manager. It's career limiting, and there's a concern about the White House starts getting your boss on your case, you could have trouble with your program's budget, the White House Office of Management and Budget, you find your budget might be cut. Then that undercuts your ability to support the scientific research that you're supporting. People defer to the White House, and if there are political people in the room, if there's someone sitting at the table, who clearly is representing the political bias of the White House, the career or professional people are going to tend to sort of back away and keep quiet and not rock the boat. I guess it's, I would like to see more cases of people coming forward, but I appreciate the position of the career people who understand that it would cause a big problem for them if they did.
So you felt...
In my particular case, I had enough. I mean, I didn't, these issues just seemed to me to be so important, the values that were at stake, that it just seemed to me that the next thing that I should be doing is rather than kind of working quietly on the inside, trying to, limit the damage and win small victories, is to just come out and just say exactly what I think and to tell what I know.
Yeah, that was 2005. That was Rick Pilz telling what he knew after leaving the Office of the Federal Climate Science Program during the Bush administration, becoming one of the very early whistleblowers, frankly, to emerge from the Bush administration. He will be joining us live. He is now the founder of ClimateScienceWatch.org. We're going to take a quick break and come back with Rick Pilz live 7 years later. See how that whole thing worked out. Brad Friedman in for Mike Malloy. Welcome back. Welcome back to the Mike Malloy Show. Brad Friedman in for Mike Malloy. Yeah, blinded. Actually, the Bush administration, I think, was trying to blind us from science is perhaps the better way to look at that. I'm joined before the break. You heard my interview, a bit of my interview with Rick Piltz after he became a whistleblower during the Bush administration back in 2005, when very few people, it seems to me, and we'll find out if I'm right, were interviewing him, were putting him on the air to make noise about what he was trying to blow the whistle on. He now joins me live 7 years later. Haven't spoken to him since then. He is, as I said, from 89 to 05. He was the senior associate in the Office of the Federal Climate Science Program, which had been in existence since 1989, serving multiple agencies in the government, in the federal government. In 2005, after resigning from the Office of Federal Climate Science, he founded ClimateScienceWatch.org in Washington, D.C. as an independent public interest watchdog project. Climate Science Watch is sponsored by the Government Accountability Project. In other words, that would be www.whistleblower.org, the nation's foremost whistleblower council and advocacy organization. Rick Piltz, sir, welcome to the Mike Malloy Show.
Hey, Brad. It's good talking with you again.
And you. It was so interesting to go back and listen to some of that
some
of that interview from so long ago. What was the reaction after all of that, after that wave of publicity you got, and what was the career fallout like for you after that happened at that point?
Well, in the immediate case of the front page story coming out in the New York Times, and which we identified essentially an oil industry lobbyist who was the chief of staff in the White House Council on Environmental Quality, who had been really acting as the political policeman on climate change communication. He resigned within a couple of days, and then a couple of days later, he was announced that he was taking a job with ExxonMobil. So he had come out of the oil industry and went back into it.
Did he resign? Was his resignation in direct response to your resignation?
As far as we can tell. Uh-huh. And he never said anything in his own defense. The White House press secretary, Scott McClellan, got grilled quite a bit about it. So it really made a kind of a concise and elegant little narrative of the fox guarding the chicken coop. I mean, I think people could understand the problem with the Bush administration's problem with integrity on global warming without knowing very much about climate models and trace gases and polar bears and and whatnot. It was a political story, so it had a fair amount of legs in that respect. It did get some network coverage, though not on Fox, and some good follow up. But
Rick, as long as you mentioned that, did Fox ever cover it at all? Did they ever?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Never mentioned it.
Not to my knowledge.
Wow. Okay.
So they bring in a new person. You know, it didn't mean that their political interference was going to stop, and it didn't mean that their policy, or lack of policy would probably be more accurate, was going to change. And it seemed to me one of the reasons I had brought the story, I finally just got out of there to talk about the story, was it seemed to me it wasn't being covered in the media. It was difficult to cover because it was so much inside, kind of inside baseball to understand and explain and try and make clear to people. And unless people on the inside would come out and tell what they were seeing, it was hard to see. So I decided that basically I needed to continue to deal with the issues that we had raised here in Washington. It's kind of an inside the D.C. Beltway project, looking at the ways climate science is misused by politicians. I mean, to put it bluntly, used, misused, abused, denied, manipulated. And so for quite a while that involved sort of throwing rocks at the Bush administration, although this is not a strictly partisan problem, and trying to get the political power elite of the country to deal with global warming and pay attention to what the scientists are telling them and deal with it effectively and with integrity turns out to be a huge problem. I mean, we have not really been able to do that yet.
And
so I started this little project called Climate Science Watch to continue to be a voice on these issues.
And you have, in fact, thrown rocks at other administrations as well. I know you got arrested last year at the White House. We'll talk a little bit about that in our next segment. But did just in the minute or so left we have in this segment, I know you were calling at the time for others to also step forward, other whistleblowers, and I don't know if it was referring just to the science issues or, you know, across the board inside the Bush administration. Did, in fact, other whistleblowers come out? Did they heed your call? Did you meet folks over the years who said, yeah, I came out after I saw what saw you doing exactly that?
Well, I was focused pretty much on the climate science, and the most high-profile person was James Hansen at NASA, who is probably the most eminent federal climate scientist. And the Bush administration tried to muzzle him from talking about the need to deal with global warming, and they told him to not accept certain interview requests and not post on his website without permission and to pre-clear everything. And he went to the New York Times, and that was another front-page story, and they had to backpedal on Jim Hansen. But, you know, most scientists, they're pretty risk-averse. They don't want to be involved in political controversy. They may not be as fearless or as eminent as Hansen. People are they don't become whistleblowers partly because they think they won't do any good and they'll get clobbered for it their career.
Yeah, and I hear, you know, I got to get to a break here, Rick Piltz, but I hear people, you know, talking all the time, people who don't like these whistleblowers say, oh, they're just doing it to get famous. Well, another whistleblower once told me, look, having whistleblower on your resume is not exactly the best thing. It's not, you know, going to help you get a job. But
there's
anyway.
More to be said about that.
Yeah, indeed. We will talk more about it when we come back. Speaking with Rick Piltz of ClimateScienceWatch.org. I'm Brad Friedman. This is the Mike Malloy Show. Stay with us. Yes, we are stuck in the middle with you for another couple of hours here on the Mike Malloy Show. Brad of bradblog.com. Speaking with Rick Piltz, the former whistleblower during the Bush administration who came out and let the world know that the Bush administration was modifying their reports on climate science to hide the effects of climate change and global warming. He then went on to found the Climate Science Watch, climatesciencewatch.org. I spoke with him in 2005, and here we are 7 years later, and I think in many ways we're still fighting the same fight. And Rick Piltz, what's kind of remarkable now is that when you came out in 2005, it was shocking what the Bush administration was doing. Now, it seems this is happening all over the place. We recently saw in just the last couple of weeks down in South Carolina, I believe it was, the legislature is talking about passing a law that makes it Des, help me out here, Desi Doyen, that makes it illegal.
It was in North Carolina.
North Carolina, there we go.
And it was making it illegal to, or they were making it against the law to use the current science to determine what sea level rise was going
to
be.
So a 3 feet sea level rise has to be
only 8 inches based on the last 100 years only, not on any other geological.
And Virginia is, they've got a policy now now that they can't talk about...
They can't use the word sea level rise in their reports of planning documents for coastal development regarding sea level
rise. Right. Now it's recurrent flooding. So, Rick Piltz, I mean, what was going on in the Bush administration was sort of behind...
Precursor,
and it was behind the cloak of darkness. We're seeing this similar denialism going on now, not just at the federal level, but at the state level, and... people are now proud of it and talking openly about this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I came to call it the global warming denial machine, and I'm not talking about people who are have some kind of intellectual skepticism, as all good scientists and intellectuals do, but this was a politically orchestrated, ideologically driven, economically driven attack on climate science and even on the credibility and integrity of the climate science community, because the science was coming up with a message that clashed with their political and cultural views.
Mm-hmm.
It implied that the government needed to take proactive steps to solve a problem. And to avoid acknowledging the need for that, they misrepresented the science. Now, with the Bush administration, the early stages of that global warming denial machine went right into the administration. But you have a corporate-funded PR and policy advocacy groups, and now to the point where global warming denialism has practically taken over a large chunk of one of the major political parties. And it is almost, it became like a litmus test for Republican presidential candidates to walk away from climate science, basically, in order to satisfy their right-wing base. It's just like one of those things that you have to be politically correct on.
That was this year, but just 4 years ago, I mean, you had John McCain and Sarah Palin even both calling for cap and trade back then, which was, you know, essentially a conservative plan to deal with global warming instead of a carbon tax. It was a market-based solution that, you know, even McCain and Palin just 4 years ago were calling for. And here we are 4 years later. I mean, in many respects, what was a secret back then, sort of a secret cabal to keep down the science. The denialism was, you know, behind closed doors back then. Now it's right out there in the open, and you've got these groups like the Heartland Institute, you know, in Chicago. They have put up a billboard a couple of weeks ago comparing climate scientists to Ted Kaczynski and Charles Manson. I mean, after all that's been said and done, And thanks, frankly, to folks like you who came out and blew the whistle, it seems like things ultimately have only gotten worse, not better, to the point where folks like you and James Hansen now even had to go to the White House and protest Barack Obama, and you got arrested there, did you not, in 2011?
Well, yes, that was the sit-ins at the White House to call on President Obama to block a permit for the Keystone XL pipeline that's proposed to bring the tar sands oil from Alberta to the refineries on the Texas Gulf Coast. Now, I think with Obama, we have not had, you know, the kind of censorship of science that we had under the previous administration. But what you had is really a lack of leadership. I mean, if you won't even find climate change or global warming mentioned on the president's reelection campaign website. I mean, it's simply not there. And he doesn't mention it in the State of Union, and he's never given a single talk, really, to the public about characterizing the global warming problem and what needs to be done. You'll talk about clean energy, but somehow they've gotten scared off as though they don't trust public opinion on this, when in fact the public, the surveys show that the public would support, most of the public would support strong leadership on this issue, and people do understand that there's a problem. And we do find that the administration, the Obama administration, is sometimes willing to kind of overlook the science when it's politically inconvenient, like when they move to permit drilling offshore in the Arctic Ocean, you know, or when they don't really move aggressively to stop mountaintop removal coal mining. Well, this Keystone pipeline, if you dig up and burn all that tar sands oil that's under the ground in Canada now, you are going to, you know, really add a tremendous amount of carbon to the atmosphere. You're going to slow down or block any kind of transition to a real clean energy alternative. And the situation there was in Obama's hands. It crossed the international border. It required, you know, the State Department to give a permit, and it looked like they were just going to push it through, you know, and just hope nobody even noticed.
And it was actually, I'm fairly well convinced here, that had the Republicans up in Nebraska not come out and said, well, we need to reroute that. You know, they were looking at this pipeline threatening their drinking water up there, their aquifer
in the Sand Hills region.
You know, and had not the Republican, I think it was the Republican governor up there who signed that bill, who said, no, we won't let the pipeline run this certain route. Had not he had not had the cover of the Republicans, I think that they might have gone ahead and approved it by now. But
You know, the thing for a long time was being fought, that battle was, it was landowners in East Texas, it was a few landowners in Nebraska, and you know, the indigenous environmental network up in Canada, and people who were just really getting no national coverage at all. And so, well, some of us decided that, you know, it would be good to nationalize this issue and bring it to people's attention and enforce it onto the radar screen. So over a period of 2 weeks, waves of people sat down on the sidewalk outside the White House and refused to move on. And it was a civil disobedience, you know, sit-in, sit-down protest. And about 1,200 of us were arrested over a two-week period, you know, and put in the handcuffs and taken off in the police wagon and so forth. And finally, that did help to attract attention. The president put the permit on hold. But what happens after the election, whether he just goes ahead and approves it, it was a temporary victory for the climate movement. But it may be very temporary.
It may indeed. I'm speaking with the whistleblower, jailbird, and director of ClimateScienceWatch.org, Rick Piltz. Have you noticed a difference as a whistleblower? And I know all you whistleblowers get together on weekends and have your conferences and parties and discussions. Have you noticed other whistleblowers who have come out since, even under the Obama administration? How has the treatment of those folks been by the Obama administration? And how has Obama's treatment of whistleblowers differed from Bush's treatment of whistleblowers?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's a mixed bag. You do have the people who are running the Office of Special Counsel now are more in, are not so much into sweeping whistleblower cases under the rug, but actually taking steps to protect the federal whistleblowers in some cases. During his campaign, Obama made statements that sounded like he appreciated the fact that whistleblowing under some circumstances can be an important part of public service and holding government officials accountable and corporations as well. But in certain areas, he has had really been very tough on whistleblowers, particularly in the national security area. One case that my sponsoring organization, the Government Accountability Project, got involved in was the case of Thomas Drake of the National Security Agency, who was just trying to bring out, fighting the battle within to stop a huge boondoggle on a multi-billion-dollar contract for this security secret surveillance stuff that was going to surveil Americans, and it was there were legal violations, and it was throwing a lot of money away on an overly expensive system that never turned out to work. And when he finally gave some non-classified information to a Baltimore Sun reporter and the story came out, they threw the book at him. They destroyed his career, and they charged him with 10 felonies, and they prosecuted him under the Espionage Act.
Yeah.
He was practically the first person since Daniel Ellsberg to be prosecuted under that, and it was just, I mean, the thing ultimately was just totally dropped before it even went to trial. It was all totally bogus.
Right.
But somehow Obama appears to be in thrall to the national security surveillance state establishment. He wants to appear tough. He doesn't want to antagonize these people. And so he's being every bit as hard-nosed as the Bush administration would have been, possibly even more so, in prosecuting a whole series of national security whistleblowers. And the intention, I think, is to create a chilling effect. This is what this is a lot of what's involved. It's like, take a look, everybody, at what we're doing to this guy.
Yep.
He's finished.
Oh yeah, I mean,
he will never, and he is a traitor. This is what's going to happen to you if you don't shut up.
Yeah, and what they've done similarly, I think, to Bradley Manning, the treatment that he has gotten.
That's right.
It is sending a very clear message, and it's kind of a scary one. All right, we got to take a quick break here. We're speaking with Rick Piltz. I know when we come back, Desi Doyen has a question for you as well. She's my producer and my co-host on the Green News Report, heard on fine progressive radio stations around the nation. And if it's not on yours, you should yell and scream and complain at your station and ask them to carry it. We'll come back with a few more minutes with Rick Piltz and some of your calls, if you like, 877-520-1150. Blowing the whistle all night long, at least for one more night before Mike returns next week. I'm Brad Friedman of bradblog.com. This is your Mike Malloy Show. Please stay tuned.
My time was running wild in me in dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself...
Good choice there, Phil. If I could only wait for the changes part to come in, I'm getting lost in Bowie land. Welcome back to the Mike Malloy Show. Brad Friedman of bradblog.com in for Mike Malloy. Speaking with Rick Piltz of climatesciencewatch.org about his experience as a whistleblower during the Bush administration, who was censoring science concerning climate change at the time. And now, of course, it's all the rage. Everybody's doing it, it seems. Desi Doyen, my co-host and the producer here of the show and my co-host on the Green News Report, has a question for you, Rick Piltz.
Well, actually, first, I have a statement, which is the work that Rick was working on when he resigned back in 2005 has actually been completed and put forth with a report, the U.S. Global Change Research Program. Did I get that name right, Rick?
Yes.
Okay, the U.S. Global Change Research Program, it's a consortium of 13 federal science agencies. They issued a report in 2009 that detailed the regional impacts of climate change on specific U.S. states and regions. So you can see the impacts for your area if you go to globalchange.gov. globalchange.gov.
And Rick, did they get the science back into that report after you left?
Yes. The first version of that, the National Assessment of Climate Change Impacts that came out in the 2000 timeframe, was suppressed by the Bush administration. To me, this was even worse than marking up some documents, because it suppressed the whole process for putting the scientists to get experts together with, you know, the public and the policymakers to diagnose where we're vulnerable to climate change and how we have to deal with the impacts. And they just absolutely sent that report into a black hole. It was never discussed by the federal government after that. The Obama administration released an updated version of that in 2009 that had been worked on quietly over a period of time. And, you know, it's a legitimate support. The global warming denial machine doesn't like it.
Oh, no, of course not.
I was actually invited, you know, back in to witness the release of that report, you know, to some place I hadn't been for quite a while since I'd resigned from the government program. So, and now they have another one. It's supposed to come out every 4 years. There's a big process underway now to produce a new national climate assessment scheduled to come out for public review at the end of this year and in final form sometime in 2013 that is going to be 30 chapters, sector by sector, region by region. What are the implications of global warming and global climatic disruption for the United States? And that is the sort of thing that should be the basis for some serious discussion by the politicians and by the public, and I'm hoping that people pay attention to it.
Yeah, one of the things that I saw in that report, again, that's at globalchange.gov, was shockingly, like the Southeast, for example, was going to go from, say, 30 days in summertime of over 90-degree temperatures to 60 or more days above 90-degree temperatures. I also have one really quick question for you, Rick, about the disconnect with the media. Obviously, polls show that there's a resilience to average Americans' understanding of climate science. So how do we get the media? What do you suggest to getting action in the media to cover this?
Well, you know, there's been so much cutback, you know, in print journalism. So much environmental and science expertise has been laid off. So much institutional memory has been lost. You know, you're really having to sort of build and rebuild some capability to discover these issues adequately. I mean, I think it's safe to say that most people could not get their arms around a problem this complicated from what they get out of the mainstream media at this point. But people will pay attention if they see that the high-level leadership is taking the problem seriously and not sweeping it under the rug. That'll help to focus people's attention. The scientists alone can't just do it with education. It requires both some kind of grassroots pressure on the politicians to take this up and some high-level leadership to focus the public attention on the real issues.
Once again, as we talked about last hour, make them do it.
That's right.
Rick Piltz, it's so great to catch up with you again. Hope we get to do this very soon. And thank you again, sir, for your service to this nation, what you did in 05, and what you continue to do ever since. Rick Piltz, director of climatesciencewatch.org. Thanks, Rick. Greatly appreciate it. All right, well, when we come back, your calls, 877-520-1150. Brad on the Mike Malloy Show.